God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Angie, I'm going to make you a co-host so you'll be able to unmute at will. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. Newcomers, is there anyone in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would just like to welcome you. Anybody, first 30 days? Just give us your hand or wave at the camera, jump up and down. All right. So the preamble of Alcoholics Anonymous says, Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open speaker ask it basket. Tonight, we are very happy to have Angie M. from Tobaccoville, North Carolina, to tell her story. After she does that, we'll take a break at the top of the hour. Do the seventh tradition, call for a few announcements, and then we'll reconvene and ask some of the questions that you were kind enough to send to me in the chat. So I had the pleasure of meeting and hearing her story. We've determined last January in Richmond at the Living Sober event, and I don't want to take up another minute of her time. You guys are in for a treat tonight. I give you Angie.
Hi, I'm Angie. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date's May 2nd, 1994. My home group is a New Life Big Book Study group in Mount Airy. And I'm going to do my best to do what I'm supposed to do, what I'm told to do, and tell y'all what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. We'll be done on time, and I won't lie on purpose. And that's about all I can tell you about how this is going to go. This is such a strange, it's uncomfortable speaking anyway, but this is so strange in the Brady Bunch boxes. But I am very honored to do this, and I thank you for asking, David. So I was born not far from here in High Point, North Carolina, grew up in Greensboro, North Carolina, youngest of three children, and a beautiful home, a beautiful family. There is nothing that caused me to be like I am. That I know of. My mother is still and always has been the most precious person I know. I have two older siblings, and they were good at everything. They were studied really hard. They went to smart kid camp in the summer. I didn't understand why they would do that, why anybody would choose to do that. They memorized all the Bible verses at Sunday school, and they got the gold stars. I mean, they were just really good at life, and I didn't like it. I didn't like them, and it was a hobby. I don't know why, but I would step on their toes. They'd retaliate. I'd cry, and they'd get in trouble, and that was what I did. I guess I was just waiting to drink, but you know, looking back, having worked the steps, I know that I was selfish and self-centered from the beginning. Everything was about me, paralyzed with fear over nothing, that sense of impending doom, and I didn't know what it was or why I felt that way. I just knew that everybody else looked comfortable in their skin, and everybody else seemed to know how to live life, and I was just an awkward, very shy. I talk a lot now, probably a little bit much for some, but I was really shy, painfully shy, and just so super aware of everything I was doing. And I just knew everybody else was judging me. But I think everybody else probably had hobbies and things to do that didn't include me. At the time, I didn't know that. my father traveled a lot. His career was really important to him. And that made us fairly comfortable. been told that I might have been a spoiled brat, but at the time I didn't know it. Everything was unfair. Nobody understood, you know, everybody had it better than me. And if you had my life, you know, you'd be miserable too. I felt so sorry for me. Again, selfish and self-centered. That self-centered fear was strong and it came out in a lot of ways. Being a snot to my siblings, being that victim was I got a lot of mileage out of being a victim. And again, I didn't know any of this. I was just trying to exist, trying to survive life, just to survive each day being in my skin. So my dad was gone a lot. Alcohol was not present in our home very often. It wasn't a big deal in our house. excuse me. I know today that my father was what the big book talks about being a heavy drinker. He drank a lot. It started causing problems in his life, and he was able to walk away from it. He was able to cut down and drink reasonably or quit for a long period of time. It didn't cause him any more troubles after he started seeing some warning signs. And that caused a lot of trouble between me and him later on, because I'd get in trouble drinking and he'd say, "You need to stop. You're getting in trouble." And I'd say, "I'm in trouble. I need a drink. You know, I got problems. You just back off for a minute. Let me figure this out. I'll take a drink and I'll level it all out." And we just didn't see eye to eye over a lot of things. My mother tried, God love her. She tried, begged, pleaded everything she could. I remember my mother, and I said something about my siblings doing the Sunday school thing. I attended church a lot. My mother had us there a lot. I felt like it was really excessive at the time. My mother and my grandmother had something tangible they took home with them from church. They had a relationship with God. My mother still does it. A relationship with her higher power that was beautiful, and it worked in her life. And I remember going to the same church, eating the same cookies, you know, doing the same things. And I felt like I just missed that. Like I didn't understand how she had something from there. To me, it was something else I didn't do well at, is what I felt like. You know, I'm here and God didn't strike me with anything, so I guess he doesn't like me. Poor Angie. So, just regular childhood, they tried their best to expose me and give me opportunities, all the same opportunities I wanted my kids to have. You know, the Girl Scouts and dance class and sports and all those things. And if I couldn't be the best, it's stupid. And I know I'm going to be the worst, so why try? And that was kind of my take on things. You know, I know today I was pretty lazy. At the time, I just felt like everything was dumb. I had a lot of cool and I was afraid somebody was going to find out I wasn't cool. So I didn't take advantage of those opportunities. I just kind of tried to do my own thing against everybody else's better judgment. When I was 9, my parents split up, and it was a sad thing. I feel like I sound horrible saying this, but they split up and it was sad, but my sister and brother were traumatized, and I found out you can get fabulous prizes when you have two different households. And everybody felt sorry for the baby, and I got to be the victim. And I remember there was a girl at school whose parents split up, and there was a big custody battle, and the dad broke in the mother's house in the middle of the night to kidnap the daughter because he wanted custody of her and he loved her so much. And I remember thinking, well, nobody tried to kidnap me. I guess they don't care about me. It's fine. You know, my definition of love was so unfair to everybody. And I didn't understand why people couldn't just do what I wanted them to do. And I shouldn't have to tell you. It wasn't long. You know, they always said that Angie could do so well in school and everywhere else if she just applied herself. And I never applied myself until I found alcohol. And then I applied myself. Same story I've heard a million times. A cool girl across the street, a little bit older than me, hung out with cool people a little bit older than me. And we were over there one night. They were drinking, so I drank. They got silly and had fun. And I found my solution. I found what made me feel comfortable in my own skin. I could finally take a deep breath. And I wasn't so aware of people watching me. And if they're watching me that night, it's because I'm fabulous. You know, it just, everything clicked into place. It probably didn't look like a miracle in other people's eyes when they watched my show, because the same thing happened that night. What happened then, I kind of repeated until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. But, you know, I got crazy. The whole neighborhood knew I was drinking. My mother was appalled and the police got called. And that's kind of what happened until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I found my solution for living, and it worked for me for a long time. At least it worked good enough. I thought it was the solution. So after that, I didn't become a daily drinker. I was a very young girl. I just sought out the people and places that said it was okay for me to drink. And you can find them if you look hard enough. There's a lot of sick, and I was one of them. I was the queen of sick, so I'm not been judging anybody else. But there were people who thought it was fine for a young girl to drink. And I thought it was because I was so mature and cool. But I think today I was just like this little drunk pet monkey that they, you know, give her a drink, see what she'll do. And so I did a lot of things to entertain people. By the time I was 15 years old, I was put in my first treatment center. And I'll just tell you that I had not hit my bottom. I hit my family's bottom, but they were high bottom folks. My bottom was a lot later, but I was already, knowing today what I know, I qualified for Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to that place. I was forced to go to that place, and I was very angry. It was an adolescent program in Burlington, North Carolina, and I was very angry about going. I wasn't ready. I didn't appreciate anything people were trying to do, and when I got there, I vowed to break out, and I did. I found another girl who was equally useless, I guess, and we busted out of this locked treatment center, and I didn't know where I was. If you don't drive, you don't know how to get places. At least I didn't. And so we're at this place, and we break out, and we get walk next door to a little quickie mart, and there was a payphone for younger friends. That's where you were tethered to something with the phone. Anyway, we called somebody who was crazy enough to come get two kids breaking out of a treatment center, and we had to sit and wait. We told them where we thought we were, and we sat and waited. And when you break out of one of those places, they call the police. And so the police officer showed up. And when the cop pulled in, we were like, we got to go. You know, we got to escape. And there's a chain link fence behind us. And this girl jumped up on the fence, climbed over, jumped down, and just took off. It was just graceful, beautiful. I did not take advantage of those sports opportunities. She must have. I don't know. But I jumped up on that fence and kind of hung there like a cat and couldn't catch my, anyway, so I fell back down, and the officer asked me if I was ready, and I said, yes, sir, and we went back to that horrible place where they were trying to help me. But I can report I stayed less than a week, and rounded up a coalition of the stupid and the willing, and we all took off, and we escaped that horrible place where they were trying to help us. It's funny, after I got sober, I guess I'd been sober 8 years or so, I saw a man in a meeting I had been going to, and he looked familiar, and weeks went by, and he finally came up and asked me if I'd ever been in that treatment center. And I said, yes, I mean, you look familiar. That was his first night working, and I escaped on his watch. Anyway, it was just really funny. Later on, we're both in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was like, I'm so glad you're not dead. So I got to make a little amends. It really freaked him out that night. So anyway, I left. And what I started doing, and none of this was calculated. It was just what I did. It was me making sure I got what I needed to feel okay in my skin. I just started using people up. And all those kids I took off with, you know, they had resources. And when their resources ran out, I was done with them. And I'd kind of pitch them and leave them where they were. I stayed gone for weeks and weeks. And I had taken off is what I was doing. I'd just leave for a while. My family always thought I was running away. When you're young and you stay on a few days, they're ready to put your face on a milk carton. But I was never running away. I was just going to drink. You know, I was going to do what I needed to do. And when I ran out, or when I hit a brick wall, or I got in trouble, or handcuffs, or whatever, I knew who to call. And they'd always bail me out of whatever. So this time I stayed gone a bit longer, and I would call my mother periodically to see if she was ready to meet my demands. You know, I'll come back if you, I'll do you all a favor if you'll do this. And I had my list of demands, hold myself hostage, you know, and she would be desperate and say, please, Angie, let's just talk. And I'd slam the phone down. I didn't know it. It wasn't a conscious thought, but I figured out that I could work with fear. But as long as they were angry, they weren't going to negotiate. And so I terrified them, I terrorized them over and over again. So I did this a lot. Finally moved out when I was 16-ish, because I was so brilliant and so ready to care for myself. So I started getting some halfway decent jobs. I went back and finished school at night at some point. But I would get decent jobs through a family member or a friend or whoever, somebody I'd grown up with. And a couple of them are insurance companies for some reason. But I would start and they'd say, boy, that Angie, she has a lot of potential. You know, she's a go-getter and she's learning things so fast and she's just going to do great. And I would do great for a little while. Sometimes it was a week. Sometimes it was a month that was pushing it. You know, a few days, whatever it was. But at some point, I felt so different from everybody else there because I had already violated those things they tried to teach me when I was young, those things they taught me about what's right and true. I had violated those, and I was not comfortable around people who weren't living that way. So I could dress up on the outside, and I could walk in there and do what they did and interact with them, but it was really hard. And at lunchtime, somebody might look at me and frown, and I think she knows. She knows what I am. You know, they all are judging me anyway. Those women that worked at those places were very kind human beings. They were doing things that that normal people do. You know, I guess they were going home, making a casserole, watching Jeopardy. I don't know, but I didn't like them. I was intimidated by them because they seemed to know how to interact with the world. They seemed to know, you know, how to get up in the morning and not come in an hour and a half late with some crazy story. You know, I didn't understand them. So when that fear hit, I'd need a drink. And I always told myself, I'm just going to knock the edge off. I'm just going to level it out and then it'll be fine. I'll just go to the bathroom, go take a break, go to lunch, whatever it is, and I'll come back. But once I start, I can't determine the outcome. And that level out, I couldn't always hit it. I overshot the mark a lot. And I had a tendency to just throw in the towel real fast. Well, I screwed up a little bit. Might as well just go for broke. And so I threw away a lot of jobs. Threw away a lot of great opportunities that kind people tried to give me. But I did this over and over and over, always starting over. If you'll do this for me, I promise I'll never do it again. This time it's going to be different. And I meant it most of the time when I said it. This time it's going to be different. I'm never going to do this again. If you'll just get me away from them, or, you know, parents, if you'll just get me another car, sorry I left that one somewhere. You know, if you'll just hook me up in another apartment, whatever it is, if you'll do this for me, I promise this time it's going to be different. I started over so many times. And I'd start strong, you know, and it wouldn't last long because I always took me, and I didn't know the problem was me. It was them. It was those people. It was my family. If you had these problems, you drink too. And I honestly never could see the correlation between my behavior and the consequences and the situations in my life. So got into some really healthy relationships. If I was in it, it was sick. I always found somebody just a touch sicker, and I'm not judging them, but they looked sicker. I could still clean it up for a little while. Just somebody a little rougher, a little bit louder, a little bit crazier than me. And people would think, look at her. She's trying to help that guy. She's such a nice girl. And it wouldn't take long drinking, and they'd say, my God, she's crazy. Why is he with her? You know, just I'd out-sick them every time. And that's kind of my MO. And some things in relationships and life in general became acceptable to me that I wasn't raised to do. And again, I'm still violating what's right and true. I was taught you're not supposed to take something that's not yours. You know, you shouldn't allow people to harm you. You shouldn't harm others. be honest, those things. And I violated all of them. And I told myself that I didn't mean it that way. I'm not that person. I'm not like them. I'll go back and make it up later. But I just continued that behavior. And I got to where I could not live with me. Never mind the discomfort of before, but the guilt, the shame, the remorse. I didn't want to be around people who knew better. I didn't want to be around people who could do better. That bar was pretty high, being around folks who were just living life. And so I just sought out people who were as sick as me. These relationships got crazy sick. There was a lot of violence. There was just always chaos. Somebody's clothes on fire in the front yard. That's true love if you're that upset after a fight. Just craziness, always craziness. And I was starring in every role. You know, it was always a drama, always a crisis. And it was always because nobody understood and nothing's fair. And God hates me or whatever. Just ridiculousness. So I periodically, my dad would try to intervene and he would say, you know, all you needed earlier was a swift kick, but if you'll do what I tell you to do, you'll be okay. And he wanted me to do things like work every day and take the trash out and, you know, just do normal people things. And I would disappoint him. I would disappoint him. I lost one of his vans one time. To this day, we don't know what happened to that van. You know, it was things like that. I'd steal from him. I'd embarrass him in front of his peers at work. You know, I always disappointed them and let them down. So I had to say, oh, I've got the most horrible father. You know, I couldn't look him in the eyes. So I'd stay away. So that happened over and over. I did those kinds of things. I met and was involved with, I call him Mr. Sick in my talk. Because he was this, we were the perfect storm of absolutely crazy insanity. And he was as sick as I was. And our whole world revolved around alcohol and running the roads. Our whole entire world revolved around it. That's all we did. That's all that mattered. And nobody needed to get in our way. So that's what happened there. We ended up having a daughter. And God's grace is that she is fine. She's a wonderful, wonderful daughter. She's a wonderful mother. She has a 7-year-old and I'm a Gigi and God is good. But, you know, people watching that show at the time said, now Angie's going to clean it up. You know, she's got a child. She's going to get it together. She's going to drive a minivan. She's going to be normal. And I wanted to, with everything I had, I wanted to be that person. I wanted to come home and do the things I was supposed to do. But what I did was I'd drop her off at my mother's and say, I'll be back in an hour. And I meant it when I said it. I was always just going to go knock the edge off and drink 2 beers and I'll come back, you know. And I did this over and over, but once I start, I can't determine the outcome. Once I start, I can't stop, and I'd stay gone. I would stay gone for however long. And then the guilt, shame, and remorse would hit me. I would come to, and I would look around, and I absolutely despised myself. So I'd have to start an argument or a fight, kick the door in, and be self-righteous and say, give me my child. You know, everybody here's just judging me. Just ridiculousness. I did these things over and over, and I'm not proud of any of this, you know, but that's what I was like. I took her places, and her younger sister, had another daughter. I took them places that I wouldn't go today with an armed escort. Not proud of it, but I made it okay in my head. Because I'm not like those people, you know. I'm not like them. I'm just passing through. You know, I don't live in it. But I did. I set up housekeeping and all kinds of crazy. So all this is happening, and I finally ran across, you know, just destroying every relationship and using people up and hurting people. I ran across Mr. Clean, and I call him Mr. Clean because he paid taxes. I mean, he was a fancy guy. He benefits, you know, didn't park in a handicap. I mean, he was a really, really nice human being. And anyway, we moved to Virginia where his whole family was, and they were all good people, and they baked together, and they played board games, they went roller skating, they did fun family functions. I never saw a potato sack race, but I think they were doing it under the cover of darkness or something. I mean, they were just wholesome, and I could not stand it. They were on a 2-beer plan. They all drank a couple of beers at night, and then they watched Jeopardy and went to bed and got up the next morning and did what they were supposed to do. And I tried desperately. I honestly did. I tried to do the 2-beer plan. But alcoholics can die doing the 2-beer plan. Or somebody was close to death. I can tell you that. It got ugly. But, you know, everybody, my family was rooting for me. Now she's going to get it together. Now she's, you know, finally on the right track. And they were so excited. You know, there was a minivan coming, and they wanted me to be that. But I can't just drink too. I broke drunk the way I drink, and shock and amazed that family. And I ended up coming back to North Carolina under the cover of darkness, because that's the way I moved, you know. Trash bags, flee the area, and like anybody would have chased me. But anyway, I was convinced they'd be so desperate to get me back. So anyway, I came back and got back into what I was comfortable in, and that's that crazy life, running the roads, Mr. Sick, here we go. You know, I gave it a try here and there. Every now and then when I would call my mother in the middle of the night and say, can you please get me some help? And she'd say, don't move. And she'd try to do it. But, you know, if it was a day or 2 days or a few hours, you know, at some point I'd say, okay, never mind. I overreacted. False alarm. I just took a shower and I feel better. I just ate food, or, you know, I slept a little while. I got this. And over and over, I did that, those false alarms, trying to get help. And there came a point when that last effort, you know, the family got me a good job, got me hooked up with it. And I went and did well and trained and was ready to roll. They got me an apartment right across the street from this great job. And they were like, you can make it just across the street. You know, it's like they were all rooting for me. Little daycare down the road where I dropped the little people off, and it was a great setup. The only problem, it was me, and I couldn't operate that well. So, you know, I was in this office with these other women who were doing the same job, and again, they were those casserole women who did everything right, and they accessorized, and you know, they hadn't been up 3 days when they came to work. I mean, they knew how to do stuff. And I would come in and just try my best to avoid eye contact with them, you know, and just keep my head down. But I always knew what they thought of me. And I always knew what I was on the inside. I thought there was no way I could ever clean up the inside. You know, I could periodically for a brief period of time clean up the outside and look like everybody else, but I knew what I was. And I thought the things I had done made me a bad person. So I would take off and drink. I'd go stay in that apartment and drink. I just need to knock the edge off before I go to the daycare and face those daycare women who are the same way. They love and nurture children, and they make casseroles, and they judge me. I didn't like those women either. And I needed to get right before I could see people. I just needed to level out enough, and it got to where I just couldn't get there. So if I didn't show up to pick the little people up at the daycare, I knew that they'd call my mother, and I knew my mother would go get them. I'm not proud of that, but that's what I did. I'd dump them off at her house and be gone, or I'd take them to the daycare, and she'd have to be responsible for them over and over again. Always with them, but you don't understand. So that's what I did, and on and on and on and on, you know. Plenty of times there were things with the children, especially. I mean, there were car wrecks, there were felony charges, there were lots of crazy things that happened. But it was the things like forgetting it was my daughter's birthday and the daycare people having to tell me. things like that that I just could not live with. You know, I could blame car wrecks on somebody else, but when I was caught being so selfish and self-centered and completely diseased, I just couldn't live in my skin. I mean, those mornings were, it was like a quit my job and drink day, you know? So my bottom wasn't the big felony charges. Everybody said, now she'll get it together. She's looking at a lot of time. That wasn't it. I needed to drink then. My bottom wasn't, you know, getting beat up. That wasn't it, you know, that was just the crazy people I need to get away from. And at my bottom wasn't all these other things that seemed so big. It was really stupid. Mr. Sick and I were in this meaningful relationship, as a friend of mine used to call it. And one night I was drinking quite a bit, and I had the most brilliant thought that he was the problem. Like, if he were to go away, all my pain would go away, you know, because it's been him all these years and he's done these horrible things. And this is why I feel so bad about myself. And so if he dies, I'll be fine. I couldn't just leave and get away from him. It had to be dramatic. So I decided to kill him that night. And I couldn't tie my shoes. I promise you, I probably didn't have on shoes. But I was going to kill him, and I decided to run him down in the parking lot of our apartments. And so I'm out there drinking, and I'm laying and waiting in that little car, and he comes out with his friend, and I dropped it down and floored it across that parking lot. I mean, I floored it. The problem is I had a drunk car, and it didn't. I couldn't really take it on big roads because it wouldn't go. It was a mess just like me. It was duct taped and bonded. It was just crazy. So I floored it and kind of creeped across the parking lot. And by the time I got across the parking lot to him, he just stepped out of the way, and I went crawling by. And I mean, I just looked ridiculous. And I was so upset that I didn't kill somebody who clearly needed killing. And B, he laughed at me. You know, it was a pathetic attempt. And I was so distraught, and it sounds so stupid, and it is stupid, but that night I thought, you know, what's the point? I drank everything I could. I consumed everything I could that night. And for a long time before that, alcohol, it wasn't fun anymore. It wasn't the bright lights. It wasn't roller coasters anymore. It was just keeping me okay in my own skin. You know, it was just numbing the pain enough to continue to exist. And that night, it wouldn't even give me that much. And that broke my heart. It would not kill the pain. And as a matter of fact, that night I drank and I drank and I consumed everything I could, and the pain got bigger and bigger and bigger. And one more time, I called my mother. She had cut me off, I don't know, a few months before that. She and my grandmother had brought groceries for my daughters. And they came up. I remember them walking up those flights of steps, and just the look of disgust on their faces, and the way I was raising those children. So they had cut me off, and everybody was talking about what to do with the children. But I called her one more time, and I asked her if she could please help me. One more time, she said, "Don't move." She sent my brother to pick me up. That night, it was the middle of the night, of course. I never wanted to get sober during business hours. She picked me up and took me to her house. And the next morning, she put me on the phone with a woman at a treatment center. And it's pretty close to where I live now. And that woman, she sounded kind. She sounded like she cared. And she said, "I don't remember if I had a bed 2 days, 3 days, and it was just shortly." And she said, "Do you think you cannot drink till you get here?" It's the first time in a long time I was honest. And I said, "I don't know." And she said, "Well, honey, why don't you ask God to keep you sober till you can get here?" I don't know how big that window of willingness was, because 10 minutes before, an hour before, 3 minutes after, I don't know, but usually I would have laid into somebody who told me to pray about anything. I would have dressed her down. Knowing her now, I don't think that would have worked well, but at the time, I would have, you know, but there was that willingness. I was willing to do anything. I just knew I couldn't hurt like this anymore. You know, it probably was my alcoholic drama, but my world, my mind said, you know what, if you try this and it doesn't work, at least they can tell your kids you tried it, because I could no longer live inside of my head, inside of my soul. I just couldn't do it anymore, and that level of pain. So I went to that place. And what I can tell you about that place is that they loved me. I walked in and I didn't feel like they were judging me. Nobody gave me that head to toe, like, what's she going to ask? You know? That's the look I got everywhere I went. My God, what's her deal? But they didn't do that. They loved me. They were kind to me. Now, they loved me enough to tell me the truth. And sometimes that stung a little bit. But I need that in my life. And God's grace is that I have continued to seek that out in my life. My sponsor today, she'll fire me up. And I love her for it. I love her for it. That is God's grace. It's a miracle in my life that, as defiant as I always have been, as selfish and self-centered as I always was, that I seek out people who will hurt my feelings. That's amazing to me, but it's part of the solution. So I left there, and I had a toolkit. I had a foundation in Alcoholics Anonymous that I've been able to build a life off of. I knew a few things I needed to do. They told me, they listed them out. In the morning, I need to get up and ask God to remove the obsession and desire for alcohol. I need to talk to another woman in the program. I need to go to a meeting, read my literature, and thank God at night. And it was like I was just watching my feet one step at a time. Okay, got to pray. Got to do what I'm supposed to do. You know, call a woman. And I tried my best to follow directions. Miracle. Again, I had never followed directions. I was so defiant. But I did my best to do what they told me to do. It didn't look pretty, I'm sure. I was still a train wreck, but I was staying sober one day at a time. Got a home group. You know, learned lessons there that I've been able to put in other areas of my life. And that's what I found for me. For me, the secret handshake to recovery is just to follow directions. I can make it really complicated, but I just need to follow directions, because they believed that I wanted what they had. So they told me what they did. And I've been watching those women, you know, I've been watching them for a long time, one day at a time, and I still want what they have. I've been able to sit on the front row and watch women in Alcoholics Anonymous stay sober through things. When I first got sober, I'd think, oh, you're going to get a pass for that. Like, they're going to let you drink over that problem, you know. Somebody's gonna bless that drunk, but no, they don't have to drink. They walk through things one day at a time with a grace and a dignity that I've tried my best to muster when life hits. I need that in my life. So I got a home group, started trying to work the steps the best I could with my sponsor. I'm going along one day at a time, trying to follow direction. There's things I don't need to be doing, like, okay, there's a list of things I don't need to do, and I need to talk to my sponsor about just about everything I do. But I was still full of that self-centered fear. And I found out that that's going to happen. The big book says when these things crop up. I mean, that means I don't flunk out of Alcoholics Anonymous when I get struck with fear sometimes. It means I can stay sober with the tools and the women in Alcoholics Anonymous. So a lot of hitting my knees, asking God to remove the obsession and desire in the morning, a lot of hitting my knees, asking God to remove the fear, the anger, the everything, you know, and working the steps allowed me to see what I needed to see and take actions that I needed to take. So I got this home group, like I said, and I learned some lessons there that I found out that all these principles are portable. When I learn them and apply them to my alcoholism and Alcoholics Anonymous, and I find out that these are portable and they go in every area of my life, like the home group thing. I found out I don't have to be right. I don't have to have the answer. I've got a voice. I can speak it. I can vote. But then God's going to work out things the way he wants it. Well, I've been able to take that to work. I don't have to be right. I don't have to be the loudest. I don't have to be the best, the worst. I can be a part of a group today. I can be a member of the family. Before, if I was in pain, I needed all the attention. I needed to scream the loudest and make everybody do what I wanted them to do. And today I can be a member of the family. I don't have to be the best or the worst or the loudest. And that's God's grace, because I've got new relationships with everybody in my family today. I got married in the program. My husband's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we thank God for good sponsorship in the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can tell you that. We got together. He had two daughters. I had two daughters. And we all got in this house, and here we are. We're going to live this sober life. And we painted our den Big Book blue. We're so foolish. It was precious. And we were going to read to the children out of the back of the Big Book every night. You know, it was just going to be one big AA meeting. And that is not what happened. We tried to monitor each other's sobriety, you know. I remember anonymous phone call tips from both of us to sponsors. You know what? He's a little crazy. You might want to give him a call. Thanks. You know, like it's the FBI tip line or something. We had this most, I don't know what the argument was about, but I remember this huge argument we had, and he was pacing up and down the hall, and I was smoking 15 cigarettes. And I mean, we were mad. He came flying in there, and this story just happens to be about him doing this, but I did it plenty of times, I promise. He came flying in there, whipped open his Big Book, and said, I think if you'll read this right here, you'd be okay. Mm. Please don't ever do that at home, because people could die. I mean, it was... He could have said the same exact passage that my sponsor would have given me, and I was not going to hear to take it from him. No. So we had to learn some lessons, but God's grace is that we have been able to do what the book talks about, and that's form a true partnership with another human being. We got an insider tip from a couple who had been sober about as long as God, and they let us know that, Angie, if you will have a sponsor and a God of your understanding and work this program to the best of your ability, Bobby, if you'll have a sponsor and a God of your understanding and work this program to the best of your ability, you can enjoy the benefits of sobriety together. And I can tell you, we've been able to do that. We try under not COVID conditions to go to a lot of retreats and things like that. And we have a lot of friends and a lot of places in Alcoholics Anonymous. That is God's grace. You know, I've been taught, and he has as well, because we've had conversations with old timers a long time ago together. You know, if I will focus on what I can bring to the relationship instead of what I want from it, what he's not doing and what I'm not getting, I get so much more out of it. When I just focus on what I can bring to him, that's a big difference. Because my definition of love was never about what I could bring to anything. It was about what people needed to do for me. And if you care, you'll do this. It was like blackmail. If you do this, then I'll do that. And today I don't have to live like that. We've had a daughter together in sobriety. So we have collectively five daughters and four grandchildren, because he's old and I'm not. We have a family today, and we've been able to be sober parents and grandparents. And one day at a time, I got to become the mother I wanted to be. One day at a time, I got to become the wife I never wanted to be, never knew I could be. I've gotten to become all those things that I just thought weren't going to be in my path, because I was convinced I was a bad, bad person. But I know today I'm not bad. I wasn't bad. I was sick. Sick people do sick things. Doesn't mean there's not consequences for them. Had to walk through some of those, staying sober and working the steps, but I didn't have to walk alone. So it was scary. Like I said, there was that self-centered fear, but I'd ask God to remove it and take the correct action anyway, in spite of the fear. I remember taking the little people to school at first, and those moms there were just like those women at the offices. They were professional moms. And I don't mean moms who had professional jobs and careers. I mean moms who were professionals. Like, they knew the organic everything, and they had all the stuff together and volunteered and had glue sticks in their pocket. But I mean, these women were out of control good at what they did. And I was learning to be sober. And I remember one of the kindergarten teachers, I didn't read the note till we were driving to school, of course. And, you know, I mean, this was me on a good day sober. And they were studying seeds, and they needed a watermelon. And so I stopped. The only watermelon they had was seedless. So I pulled the sticker off and sent her in. You know, that was me sober, trying my best. One day at a time, just trying to function, you know. But I would walk in the school, and I'm trying to do the right thing. And I would feel like everybody was going to know. Like, I was waiting for the announcement over the intercom. There's an alcoholic in the building. Please remove your children. Don't look her in the eyes, you know, but that didn't happen. And one day at a time, just one day at a time of doing my best and making amends when I fell short and just trying to live this program. One day at a time, God, Women and Alcoholics Anonymous sponsor, trying my best to live this program. I became comfortable in my own skin because I know today it's about my relationship with the God and my understanding. That's the one I need to work on. I need my sponsor to help me. I trust her with everything. And I know she loves me no matter what. If I am living in the solution, everything else is going to shake out. I know that today. I don't need to worry about what those women think of me. Today, I know what I am, and I know that I'm doing the best I can do to live by what that which is right and true. And that's the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went back to school, got an education, and today I get to work at a place that I love with people that I love and do things I'm honored to do, and that is still amazing to me. You know, I try my best to live in gratitude, and I can still be a spoiled brat and hold my breath and stomp my feet, but either somebody will point it out, or I'll get tired of feeling uncomfortable and do something different today. The pointed out people are still in my life. You know, I've gotten to be the daughter that my mother deserves. You know, I did the formal amends with her, but I continue to try every day to be the daughter that she deserves, to make those living amends. And I feel good about me doing that. I used to think I'll always feel guilty, you know. But when I'm living in the solution today, that guilt's not there. You know, I can sit around and kick me for the things I did to her and my children and everybody else, but I don't have to today. I get to live in the solution because it always doesn't have to be about me. My father died when I was about a year and a half sober, and that relationship was repaired. I had made the formal amends, but again, I was spending time with him. I was doing things that interested him. You know, I was trying to see what I could bring to his life. His health was very bad, and before he died, we got some tough news, and I was he'd asked me to walk through some things with him, and I was trying my best, and I didn't know what to say when that news hit. See, when I was drinking, when those things happened, it was about me. They called the family in for him a couple of times when I was drinking, and I had to make it about me. I couldn't try to see what I could bring to him or help my family. It was, I'm in pain, so I'm going to scream the loudest. And I didn't know what I was doing, but it just, the focus was always on me. But sober, I was able to see what I could do for him. And he looked at me during that situation and said, "My God, I wish I had a program for my life like you've got for yours." See, I didn't even know it. I had my head down, and I was trying my best to just follow directions one day at a time, you know. Do the things on the list they told me to do, and don't do that other stuff, you know. Don't use those old skills, those old tools, because they'll kill me today. And he saw a difference in me. That blew me away. We had a good relationship when he died. And that is God's grace in Alcoholics Anonymous that I was able to get that. He wasn't ashamed of me. and I could look that man in the eyes. And that is something I'm incredibly grateful for. So all those times drinking, there was a friend of mine who I called to bail me out of all kinds of craziness. And when I escaped from Virginia, that person drove up in the middle of the night. I mean, just always, always bailing me out of craziness and trying to help me. And every now and then that person would say, you know, you probably need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would give a really witty comeback and move on. And as a matter of fact, just a week or two before I got sober, I called and this friend said, you know what, I can't help you anymore. I'm done. And of course, I was very distraught and upset because nobody, you know, people would warn me for years and it was still a shock when they got done. You know, I'm not going to do this again. But it was always a shock when they stopped doing it again. When I first worked the steps and got to the amends list, my sponsor and I decided I could find this person to make amends. And I contacted the person's family and said, this is what I'm doing. I had my amends cape on and everything, and I wanted to make amends. And his mother said, you know, the best amends you can make is just leave him alone. And I was really upset. But my sponsor showed me in the book, again, that my job was just to remain willing. And if it was God's will, he put me in his path or him in mine. 18 years later, I got a call, and his wife called and said that he was dying. He had brain cancer, and he wanted to see me. And I got to make those amends. I got to make those amends at the perfect time. It was God's timing, because I was able to go and make it about him and my gratitude for knowing him and what he brought to my life. And that's God's grace. I guess I would have screwed it up that first year of sobriety. God said, hold on. Those are things that just don't happen. I mean, to me, they're just part of the miracle of this program. you know, there have been tough times in the program. Something happened to someone I love a great deal a few years ago. Some folks harmed someone I love. And it was fundamentally wrong. And my old way of thinking, when I got angry, somebody's got to hurt. I hurt, you're going to hurt. And I was 18 years sober, 17, 18 years sober. But I got really angry. And I used to call that ball bat angry. I mean, I got very angry. And, you know, God's grace is that I didn't have to act on that, my old selfish and self-centered ways, because I've been sober and Alcoholics Anonymous, because I've tried my best to follow directions one day at a time and just do those things that I'm supposed to do on a daily basis. I was able to see what I could bring to her life rather than what I needed to do to make me feel better. That's God's grace. You know, nobody said you've been sober too long to act like that or to be that angry. You know, you've been sober too long to feel that way. They didn't say that. They told me they loved me. And it was like, looking back, it was like the people in my home group, the women in my life in Alcoholics Anonymous were just holding their arms out. You know, they're kind of spotting me. So I didn't know how to do that. I didn't know how to navigate that kind of pain. But I was able to. Women in Alcoholics Anonymous out of my understanding and just trying my best to live these principles I've been taught. Watching, stalking those old timer women paid off, because I got to try my best to do what they did. A little shred of grace and dignity. And I got to be there for her rather than, again, making it about me, suffering consequences that would have not helped anything. Me in jail is not going to help anybody. You know? So, you know, life is good. It's different right now, obviously, but change is the name of the game, I guess. You know, going to meetings, going to my home group online is strange, but I'm so grateful for it. I absolutely love my home group. You know, I'm not able to go down and physically be with my sponsor, but we are blowing up phones and doing all kinds of things. You know, God has put the people in my life that I need, and I'm I'm grateful. I have it always comes to mind, you know, that the person that I was is not who I am today, but who I am today is nobody I would have wanted to be, honestly. You know, I lost my cool and I'm fine with it, man. I was a lot of things. I was called a lot of things drinking, and I earned every one of them, every badge, every horrible thing. They were accurate. But today I think I'm some other things. Today I get to be a mother, a wife, a GG, best job on the planet, an employee, a sister, a daughter, a friend. But I could be none of those things if I were not a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So for that, I'm incredibly grateful. And I'm really grateful that I'm done with things.
Thank you, Angie. That was amazing. I've given everybody the opportunity to unmute. Thank you, Angie.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Angie.
Thank you, Angie. Appreciate
thank you,
it.
Ma'am. Very much. Thank you, ma'am.
That was so
thank
awesome.
You, Angie.
Thank you for your service, Angie.
All right. I'm going to take the meeting back again. The seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. I've placed a link in the chat for the PayPal link at Simple Actions. We do contribute to the other service entities in Alcoholics Anonymous. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Just by way of reminder, Larry is the user. It's just Larry W. He's got a red question mark. Chat your questions to Larry. Anything you'd like to ask Angie. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. I'd be happy to take just a few announcements for the good of AA. If you could raise your virtual hand, I'll recognize you. All righty. Our home group meets regularly on Monday nights at 7 o'clock. We've got some great speakers on a step tomorrow night. And next Sunday, we've got Doug R. from Los Angeles, California, in the Sunday night speaker Ask It Basket. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we will be available here after we close the meeting. Please stick around. You may have come in alone, but you do not have to leave that way. Or if you are shy, you can send an email to info@simpleactions.net. Okay, Larry has renamed himself to questions. So we've got a couple coming in. Please keep them coming. Angie, thank you so much. That was just so heart, all beauty. We have a question here. I wonder if you might say a few words about what being a home group member is meant to you. I'm curious if you're still a member of the same home group when you came in, and just anything about your home group experience that you'd like to share.
I'm not a member of the same home group because I moved. But that first home group, again, that's where I learned how to be a member of a group. Responsibility, being there, you know, having a job and keeping my word. important, and just having that group of people that know me, you know, if I'm not there, somebody's going to call, you know, if I'm there and look a little wacky, somebody's going to pull me aside. And that's what I need. When I moved, that was really hard to change home groups, because of course nobody does it right. You know, nobody does it like my home group. So when I moved here, I got a changed home groups, obviously. And just recently, a few of us started a group, and it's a big book study group, and it's got some history component to it, and it just fills my heart up. It just feels right. The other group was wonderful, and I love it, and I'll still attend as soon as we can. But that's just what I need in my life, or a tribe. You know, I guess that drive. I've got people in Alcoholics Anonymous everywhere, and I meet new people, and the circle gets bigger and bigger. But I need my core, my home group, and I'm grateful for it.
Thank you. What suggestions would you give to someone fresh off a relapse?
Get a good sponsor. Get a sponsor, and you know, just ask for help. And like I said, follow directions. That's been the key for me. I mean, I want to get brilliant and freestyle it and, you know, do things my way, and that won't work for me. And I really don't like to talk to women, but they will ask me, honey, how's that working for you? For me, it's just those fundamentals. It's the fundamentals of Alcoholics Anonymous, the things I talked about. Asking God to remove the obsession and desire in the morning. Lead God to direct me through the day. Talking to my sponsor. Reading the literature. Going to meetings and thanking God. It, you know.
You mentioned it several times when you were talking, just trying to do what they told me to do and trying not to do what they told me not to do anymore. And so I think you mentioned them, but maybe it's worth bullet pointing some of those. What were some of the things they told you not to do?
Oh gosh, I mean, they would they tackle you. You better stay away from the man, Angie. That they didn't mind hurting my feelings. You know, it was just you know, keeping my word. Don't, you know, it's just being honest. You know, not. I found out that those old lies that I always told because I thought I had to, you know, those stories I told myself that when I worked the steps, they weren't accurate, you know, but I can stop mid-lie, you know, and I can kind of take a look, step back. Usually I don't have to make a snap decision about most things, you know, I can respond instead of react to life. But usually if I didn't know what to do, that was probably something I didn't need to be doing. So it was just to halt a minute and talk to somebody. But I learned about just even in that home group and some of the silly things, you know, that I was sitting out front with another girl with two newcomers, and we're out there in front of the meeting after the meeting one night, and we are running some other poor creature on this earth in the ground. Some girl in AA, she wasn't doing it right. You know, she never read the important parts of the book or whatever. We were running her in the ground. And this man who I respect a lot, he'd been sober a long time, walked out. And of course, we're like, hey, don't you agree? And he said, who are you talking about? We told him, he said, it's one of the finest people I know. And he walked off. It was like, whoa. I don't want to be this person. You know, I want what that person has. And of course I had to talk to my sponsor, tell them myself and pray and then try to reach out and be kind to that person. But those are the lessons I've learned by watching people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't have to participate in that. I don't have to be the belle of the ball, be the funniest one. You know, I don't have to put other people down to lift me up. Those are things that I've it sounds simple, but those are things that the lessons in my life that have changed my check for the good.
All right. What helped you get over that feeling of being judged?
I don't know. I'm just not that important. being right-sized. You know, I believe God hears my prayers no matter if I'm driving a car or doing it. I can't do a cartwheel, but, you know, whatever I'm doing. But for me, when I get on my knees, I feel humble. I feel right-sized, and it's a reminder to me that that I'm right where I'm supposed to be, that God's got this, and I'm just in his hands. And for me, that's a good reminder. I'm not that important. These people don't get up in the morning to judge me, and if so, maybe they'll find a hobby, but I'll just pray for them and move on. But just doing an inventory, you know, my character defects, that self-centered fear, that was the root of all my stuff. And it came out in so many different ways. I guess working the steps and trying my best to invite God into my life and take him with me throughout the day.
Thank you. Let's see. We've got one that says, do I have to talk to my sponsor about everything, or can I just talk to them about my alcoholism?
I don't know what everybody else has to do, but I know I want every drop of recovery they make. So I talk to my sponsor about everything. I want what she has, and it's an incredible feeling for me, having done that fifth step and then, you know, being able to keep on the same page by filling her in on what's going on. It's a great feeling to know there's somebody on this planet that knows everything about me and loves me unconditionally. I need that in my life. I don't need secrets anymore. They used to say when I got sober, you're only as sick as your secrets. And I don't need to keep those anymore. I don't need to hide a part of me, shield a part of my life. That was what I did drinking. So for me, I want it all, so I better tell it all.
All right. Have you ever been close to picking up a drink in sobriety? And if so, what did you do to move past it?
I can't remember how long I've been sober. I remember my first home group. It was actually my husband's sponsor. Used to say this all the time. He said, you know, there's going to come a time where you're not going to be able to get to a meeting. You're not going to be able to call somebody in the program. Not even going to have your big book. And the only thing that's going to keep you sober is whatever relationship you built between you and the God of your understanding. And I am so grateful that he said it, and I heard it so many times. I heard it, and I was driving. I don't remember. I think I was a couple of years sober, but I know where I was driving from and to, you know, exactly where I was. And the thought hit me. I could drink and nobody would know. And thank God for this, watching my feet and just following direction, because it became a part of what I do. I pulled over the side of the road and asked God to remove the obsession and desire for alcohol. And then I flew home and called my sponsor and went to a meeting that night. And for me, just telling on myself, not that I did anything bad, I mean, but just saying these things out loud and not keeping that a secret. My pride and ego wanted to say, well, I'm sober. I'm queen of my little AA group. I don't want anybody to know I thought about drinking, but I need that honesty and being right sized. So, yeah, I certainly had thought about it, but thank God I tried to take God with me.
Thank you. Do you have I'm just reading the question. Do you have any advice on how to double down on 12-step work in the current COVID/remote/Zoom environment?
Somebody has sponsors on here now. Let's put her on the spot. This curve, Brittany, I'm on. I mean, I don't have advice. I don't give advice. My experience is that my sponsor and I talk a lot, and you know, doing all this Zoom stuff, and I try my best to talk to the people I sponsor as often as I can and step up on meetings. I mean, I think it's we just have to be there for each other. Thank God people are there for me, and I try my best to be there for them. But advice, I don't know. I think it's just making sure I do what I've been taught to do. And sometimes it means watching my feet, because this can all be a distraction. So it's really just remembering who I am, and trying my best to continue to follow directions.
All right. I've got, let's see, it says, Rule 62, tell me about it. Angie, you have a great sense of humor. My sponsor taught me how to laugh at myself. Did yours?
Yeah, I'll tell you who did. The old timers in my first home group, they taught me how to laugh, because I finally figured out they weren't being cruel laughing at me. Oh, that is stupid. Okay, thank you. You know, they'd say things like, did you hear what you just said? Well, wait a minute. It sounded good in my head. But yeah, we had a group that we went out to. There was 20 of us. We went out to dinner after meetings, or we'd go for coffee. And we were a very active tribe. And I learned early on that we are not a glum lot. And I had a picture in my head at one time that being sober meant I was going to sit in a rocking chair and knit, and life would be dull, and knitting's fine. I can't do it. I've tried. So I admire anybody who does, but we're not a glum lot. Sobriety's fun, you know, like I said, retreats and conventions and just coffee before and after, and friends who are, again, my tribe, you know, the people who, my world is just really big today, and it's a lot of fun. So yeah, my sponsor loves to laugh. She is quite the animated human. She is not shy, and she's loud, and she's hilarious, and I love her. So yeah, she teaches me to laugh and not take me so seriously.
Well, we know we were going to get this question. Anything to share about relationships in AA when you're both in the program?
I need to mind my business. Now, I'll tell you a secret. I still dabble in minding his business sometimes. See if he's listening. You know, just what those old timers taught us, you know. I got to work on me and love him. And let him do what's right and true between him and his God, which might be different than what's right and true between me and my God some days. But, you know, we get to stay on the same path together. We've both got to do the work, though. I got nothing. I don't have much of anything special and unique. It's just my experience is trying, again, to follow directions. I hate to fall back on that, but I'll stay there. I'm okay. My sponsor and her husband are both in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we get to watch them and see how, and I've been watching, like I said, I've been watching people since I got here. I remember watching, there weren't a lot of women in my first home group, but there were a lot of Al-Anon women that came and hung out. And I know all the Al-Anon jokes, and they're funny, but I got to watch the way they interacted with their spouses, their children, their friends, their community. And I wanted what they had too, you know? So I kind of watched them and went, oh, they're not wearing barware. I'm going to, you know, they're not making everything about them. You know, it's just trying my best to live life with these spiritual principles. And I get a lot of that from watching others.
I have a question here. Did you have any resentments in early sobriety? How did you overcome them?
Oh, I've never had resentments. I'm far too spiritual for that. You mean like yesterday? That's resentments. Oh, gosh. I got to work a resentment fully justified. You know, it's like I said, it's telling on me, for me, you know, getting that out, being honest about it. You know, I've learned that it's just okay to be sick, you know. I mean, I want to dress it up and pretend that I never have resentments and I'm far too spiritual and I don't want my sponsor to know I'm sick. Well, guess what? She knows. She has the same thing I do. And thank God she'll share with me some nutty stuff in her world, you know? And if I thought you had to be perfect to be in recovery, I'd have flunked out a long time ago and probably died drunk. So, yes, resentment, steps, look at me, find my part, fourth column. That's all I know to do with resentments.
So, let's see, sponsorship. Do you have the same sponsor since you came in, or how many sponsors have you had? What would you like to say about it, the people who've sponsored you or the people that you sponsor?
I had one sponsor for quite some time. I'm so grateful to her for everything she did for me, and we just got to a different place. And so I've got the sponsor I have today. I think I had somebody, I would have asked a tree to sponsor me when I got sober. I mean, I might have had somebody there for 10 minutes and didn't call her or whatever, you know. But I had that one sponsor for a long time, and now I've had this sponsor for a long time. Sponsorship again is for me honesty and being reliable and my first sponsor and I became really good friends, and I'm friends with this sponsor, but I think I need my sponsor to continue to take my inventory, and I need to be willing for that to happen. And sometimes that doesn't feel good. Anyway, people I sponsor, I don't know. God always puts a woman in my life when I need them, and I'm so grateful for that. About the time I get tangled up in me and all this crazy stuff happening, COVID hits and the world's ending, and and I'm going through all these things in my head, God puts these women in my life, there are a couple of women I've sponsored for quite some time, a couple that are rather new, and that is the bright spot of my life. That's what the big book says, absolutely a bright spot of my life. I get to see me, I get to hear me, I get to make it not about me. I mean, it's just people say, I didn't want to bother you, so I didn't call. Please bother me. Please call, because I need to remember what I'm supposed to be doing today. I might get ready to throw a chair out the window. Who knows? Oh, that's right. There's a woman in AA. I need to do something. I need to get out of me. I don't throw chairs. But this is really weird. Thank you. Sorry about that.
It's all good. Is there such a thing as having too many sponsees?
I don't know. I mean, I just need to stay in touch with my sponsor. For me, if I don't have the time to give to them, then I should do something different, try to point them in a different direction, because that's not fair. My sponsor's always there for me, so I need to be able to give what she's been given to me, try to. I don't know the magic number, but I think everybody's different.
I've got a question that says, I am so angry at being an alcoholic. Have you ever felt that way? How did you get over it?
There was a time that being an alcoholic was the worst thing in the world. When everybody was screaming at me to stop drinking, when they were dragging me to treatment centers, and if I could just drink and knock the edge off, I'd be okay, but nothing works out. That was a bad time to be an alcoholic. But when I came in and I went to that treatment center and I came in Alcoholics Anonymous and went to big book studies and tried to digest what was in this book, I found out that there's a solution just for me. Being an alcoholic is no longer a liability, because I've got a solution that is an absolute benefit to my life. But that's just for me. I can be angry, but it ain't going to change nothing. A friend of mine used to say, you're going to have to give up hope for a better past, honey, because you ain't going to get it. And I can't change that. I'm an alcoholic. I will always be an alcoholic. There is no way for me to drink successfully. God's graces, I've got a solution today that to me looks pretty good. To me, I can't imagine a better way to live. So there wasn't a solution, man, that'd suck. Sorry, that would be quite unpleasant.
All right. I have a question. How do I tell my children about alcohol and or my alcoholism?
You know, I don't know. For me, our kids were raised in Alcoholics Anonymous. We drug them to meetings when they were small, and we offered them all Alateen, and by extension, Al-Anon. Only one chose to attend, and that was a good thing in her life.
We've just, they've always been there. They went to meetings with us. They've seen the sponsees come over. They know our sponsors. They used to play when they were small, count the big books in the house. And I mean, it's just, they used to play AA meeting too, fight about who's on chair.
I guess, you know, a couple of the older ones kind of lived some of it, so they knew it wasn't a shock. All I know is we used to look at each other every now and then when they were smaller and say, you know, it's easy to go to a meeting and live this thing, you know, dress it up and go in and say what I'm supposed to say and act how I'm supposed to act. It's easier than doing it at home. And we were always talked about being very mindful of bringing the program home and trying to live it there, because the worst thing in the world, I remember my husband saying this, he thought the worst thing in the world would be for one of them to meet Alcoholics Anonymous and say, oh, my parents went there and they were crazy. I want them to know that there is a solution if they ever need it. And I think that they know that today. Not always because their parents were working a program, but they are people around us that they've learned from as well. So I've been open about it with them. Most of them have heard my talk and his talk, and that's awkward, but again, if they ever need it, I want them to know where to go, and they know it's an illness, and they have a great love and empathy for alcoholics. So not a bad way to grow up in a spiritual program. I tell you, my youngest daughter, she went to Swaziland in Southern Africa for a year. And she had the interview for this thing. It was a religious organization that was hiring people. And they asked her about her spiritual background. And she told them about, you know, attending church and different things. But she said, I got the God of my understanding in a relationship with that God, because I grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous, and both of my parents were members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's where I learned about God of my understanding and trying to help others. And I'm incredibly grateful that she got to see those examples, again, not just in me or her father, but in just the community, the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's incredible to me. I'm kind of rambling. Sorry.
Well, we are out of time. I can't think of a better place to land than that. That was beautiful. I'd like to thank everyone who participated. And I'll give everybody the opportunity to unmute after we say the Lord's Prayer. Okay. And I've asked Debbie to read the last two paragraphs, or technically three, on page 164, and I'll share that now.
I'm an alcoholic. My name's Debbie.
Hi, Debbie.
Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thanks.
Thank you, Debbie. Thank everyone who participated. Thank Larry for wrangling the questions. My co-hosts, BJ and Jessica. And if we could, let's do a big virtual circle and virtually hold hands and have a moment of silence to do with as you wish, followed by the Lord's Prayer. Our Father,
Father,
who art in heaven,
hallowed
be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.